This is Cincinnati Edition, recorded on the Miami University campus in Oxford. I'm Mark Haney. We're in the Athletic Performance Center today, joined by a studio audience. One of the rules in journalism is that reporters are supposed to be objective in their coverage of events, no matter what they might believe personally. That's changing. There's been an increase in reporters who consider themselves activists, as well as a growing call for more advocacy journalism. And joining us to discuss journalism in an age of activism are Miami University Senior Lecturer of Journalism, Patty Gallagher Newberry, and Political Science Lecturer, Dr. Chris Kelly, Cincinnati Enquirer Race and Community Reporter, Mark Kernute, who's also on the Miami University faculty, and WVXU reporter, Tana Weingartner. And good afternoon to all of you on the panel. Thank you for being here today.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for having us.
Patty, what do you see as giving rise to the number of journalists who are also activists these days?
Well, I'm going to take a little bit of an issue with your premise, Mark. I don't think that most traditional journalists, the kind of journalists that I revere, would consider themselves activists. I do see a rise in the coverage of activism in our country, which correlates with the rise of activism itself. But when I look to the Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN, the networks and so forth, I don't see that journalists are participating in these various movements that we've seen in the last, say, 3 to 4 years, really kind of dating to the Black Lives Matter movement. I'd challenge your premise a little bit or ask you to expand on it.
And maybe I'm confusing terms. Is there a difference between activists and advocacy journalism? Are those two different things?
Advocacy journalism is usually defined as a news organization that is transparently on one side of the political question, right, and makes no bones about it. Activism, I think, is a little bit different. I assume there are some journalists for some news organizations that would identify as activists for the causes that they also write about and post about. But in the higher echelons of journalism, I don't think that many journalists would characterize themselves as activists.
Chris, let's get your thoughts on this.
Yeah, I think most traditionally trained journalists would reject being classified as activists or advocacy, unless, of course, they work for Mother Jones or one of the partisan media outlets. I do think, though, that as a result of media fragmentation over the last 25 years, there has been an expanded role in people who consider themselves journalists but didn't get trained at a university or go through a journalism program. They're just interested in disseminating information for public consumption. And as a result of that, they're reaching larger and larger audiences, which is in part fueling partisanship at the mass level, not just at the elite level. And I think those individuals clearly reject the idea of balanced and objectivity, and they take a point of view in the reporting or the disseminating of information that they do, either on their blog sites or through Twitter or some other social media platform. And these people are more and more, they're being invited into presidential press conferences and getting access to the kinds of venues that traditionally were walled off to them. And so I think having these individuals now part of the pool of individuals engaged in quote-unquote journalism, it makes it harder and harder to tease out those lines for the general public between individuals who are traditionally trained journalists and individuals who are really engaged in point-of-view journalism.
So, Mark, what do you think? Can a journalist be an activist?
I don't think so. I think Patty is really on target there, that you have to maintain to the greatest degree possible objectivity and balance. I think what happens, you know, because I cover Black Lives Matter, I cover immigration, people who want immigration changes in immigration law. I cover the Muslim community and Islamophobia. I think what you have to do is kind of those forces that work against those groups will often only give you a statement, and they will kind of hide. And so I think maybe what readers at least may see is you don't have a story that, at least from an inch or a word count, is balanced. So the stories are filled more with the people who are accessible to you and giving you information. For example, if you're covering a Black Lives Matter rally, you know, and you're talking to leadership and people who are participating, that fills the physical space of your story, where if you approach then the police or during the Ray Tenzing trial, the two trials we had, you know, you'll only get small bits of information from the official sources. So if you have a 20-inch story or an 800-word story, it may look out of balance because you're going to fill that with a lot of that, you know, as Patty said, the rise of the activity on the streets, the protests, the marches. You know, the majority of the information that's available to you and the sources are from the agitators, the protesters, and the official sources kind of give you just a tiny bit and don't make themselves directly available to you.
And a lot of times there's not, you know, a counter. There aren't at least the same number of counter events to find and get those and tell those stories too, right? These are people who are, you know, maybe they're at home and they feel strongly about their side, but again, they're relying on their one person to do the speaking for them.
Ten, have you ever run across a situation in your reporting work where you found it difficult to stay neutral in the story?
Difficult to stay neutral? I don't think so. I would hope not. I mean, you always do have to kind of challenge yourself and ask and make sure. Now, have I not provided the full story here? I need to look at it, and that's the importance of editing and having someone else edit your work. I mean, I guess the closest I could think of is everyone knows I'm a giant soccer fan. So when I cover FC Cincinnati, I really do have to, you know, look at myself and say, make sure I'm not just writing an, oh boy, soccer story, you know. That would be my closest analogy, hopefully.
Yeah. What about you, Mark? Have you ever had a situation where you found it was difficult to maintain your neutrality when you're writing about a topic or a situation, you know, that somebody was in?
That's a good question. I don't think you find it hard to keep your neutrality. I think as a human being, you feel and understand and are sensitive to oppressed people, to, you know, the dreamers, the, you know, the young people who are living here on DACA, who are hanging by a thread and aren't certain of what their future holds. You know, young people that have played by all the rules and, you know, were brought here as children that had no control over coming here with their parents or family members. You're very sensitive to them. And again, you know, for example, when you cover an active deportation case where there's an arrest, you know, ICE, you know, the government will only give you small bits. And, you know, again, you spend that time with people and you get to know them and you have them on, you know, their names are in your cell phone and you get to know them as human beings and you become very sensitive to their situation and you try to report that, but you don't say, you know, you don't come out and say in your story that, you know, our immigrant, you know, it's the columnist's job or the, you know, the opinion writer. That's their job. You know, my job is to help you get to know these people, know their situation, and also try to understand, you know, the government situation, the lawmaker situation, why they're pursuing this or emphasizing certain things within immigration law. But yeah, it's hard. I think the challenge becomes as a human being, it's hard to remain cold and icy and detached when you spend time with people over a period of time and see what they're going through. And, you know, really when they want largely what, you know, all parents want, they want safety for their children. They want to be able to educate their children. And you, you have to do, as Tana said, that's you know, where a really good editor comes in. And if you're having those kind of issues, you speak with your editor about that. But it's a challenge, because that's the predominant work that I do, is in, you know, communities of oppressed and marginalized people.
Have either of you ever been accused of writing an unbalanced story?
Of course. I mean, who hasn't? Especially, you know, during a presidential election, if you go and you cover, say, when one of the candidates is in town, then everybody who is for the other candidate says that your story is horribly one way. And then 2 weeks later, when the other candidate comes in, all of the other people tell you that your story is horribly the other way around. I mean,
So you feel stuck between a rock and a hard place sometimes?
Or? I think that means I'm telling a balanced story if I've got everybody mad at me.
Yeah, there's an adage, and Patty, having been an active journalist in her career, if you get complaints from both sides, we take that as a good sign that you're staying in the middle, where if both sides somehow feel that you're being unduly fair or favorable toward another side of this, if you get blowback and backlash from both sides, you almost take a deep breath, and that's kind of an indicator that you at least stayed in the middle the best of your ability.
Yeah.
Patty, do you think it's possible to present a sympathetic story but yet remain factual and unbiased in presenting that story?
Yeah, certainly. As Mark said, he's telling stories of disadvantaged people, people at the margins, and there's a certain amount of empathy you bring to those as a storyteller. You're seeking the human moment and so forth. I understand the public impression, however, that journalists have become activists. And I really do think, however, it's a direct reflection of where society has been in recent years. The news of the day has been so many different activist movements, going to Occupy Wall Street in 2011, the Black Lives Matters movement beginning in 2013, the women's marches that erupted after the election of Donald Trump. We've had a lot of activity on white supremacy, 2016-17, the Me Too movement, which erupted in 2017, and now most recently, gun activism. So these are big stories of the day. The fact that journalism covers them in a big way, I think, does sometimes lead the public to think we're like on board. You know, these are our causes, when in fact we're simply reflecting society's interests and activities.
And we're taking questions from our audience today, and go right ahead.
Thank you. My name is Sally. I am pleased to hear you're speaking of marginalized persons that are important for us as a nation to understand and locally. I would wonder, well, let me say this. I'm from Erie, Pennsylvania. And it's a city that I'm appreciating very much, that NPR is highlighting as a very changed city politically. I'm caused to feel that the importance is that coverage happens with those whom we may not have called marginalized before, but I think we're really discovering these are persons, in many cases, who have become marginalized. And I wonder what responsibility you feel that journalists need to be taking to try and help us as a nation to understand this marginalization and to be able to help us become healed.
Do you mean, like, economically marginalized or just marginalized in general?
Well, I think economics plays a big part, and it ends up becoming much that will trigger societal and social, et cetera, personal issues. So I think economics is probably the biggest.
Sure. Yeah, and you're exactly right. And the unfortunate thing is that often these communities only get exposed when they reconfigure the electoral lineup.
Yes.
And so 2016, we saw that, the breaking of the blue wall. President Trump was able to, or candidate Trump was able to resonate or harmonize what these people were feeling. And as a result of that, they came to the fore as if they hadn't existed ever before. And I think that one of the problems has been, at least in the last 50, 60 years, is that more and more as a beat in our news media, there's been a disappearance of a labor beat, where labor was often tied to organized labor. And as organized labor has lost its clout, the size of it politically, it's almost as if that's disappeared, as if those are the only workers that exist in the United States. And so as a result of that, and this is true racially, ethnically as well, yes, is that these communities, they get overlooked. They get overlooked because their problems are hard to describe. They get overlooked because in some cases they are aligned with one party or the next. And as a result, we make sort of summary judgments of who they are as if that really is who these people are and what their daily lives are like. And so I would hope, although I don't think, but I would hope that we'll see in continued coverage of depressed communities, because, you know, the heartland has lots of depressed communities. I mean, my father came out of Appalachia, Kentucky, and it's all they have horrible problems, and all those problems just don't fit neatly into any kind of storyline, and they either get described as communities that are drug dependent, communities that are unemployed, or what have you. And 2016 explained that's not who these communities are.
The importance of covering who these people are, for someone who served in political office for a while, on issues that would very much have affected these people, these persons, I would really want to say. I think the importance of what the media is reporting about these persons is to help both those who are in public service and those who are a part of the electorate needing to understand how we can better serve these. Journalism plays, in my hope, a part of helping us become healed.
If I can pick up on that, Sally, your original question is, what responsibility does journalism have to understand, report on, help heal the issues that affect some of our communities? I think that journalism has a major responsibility, an awesome responsibility, to tell stories from communities that are struggling, to tell human stories, to tell nuanced and important stories in important ways, to seek coverage that's not perpetuating stereotypes, painting Appalachia, for example, as all poor, undereducated, drug addicted, et cetera. The problem is the resources are not there, right? We've had a real collapse of the business model of journalism. We have much diminished and contracted news organizations, and so stories that might have been told a decade ago, 2 decades ago, go to the wayside. News organizations have to make choices every day where they're going to assign their limited resources. There are a couple of silver linings, however. There's a major project underway called Report for America, which would act kind of like a Peace Corps or a Teach for America organization. It's got 2 pilot projects underway to assign journalists to go into underreported parts of our country to tell stories of economic struggle or whatever, you know, might be the circumstances. And here on our campus, I'm happy to say that my boss, Dr. Richard Campbell, has launched a project called Report for Ohio that is at this very moment working with a group of students and another academic to figure out how this might look and how it might work with Report for America. So there are a lot of efforts underway. I think it's a recognized problem, looking for solutions.
Thank you.
And I think, if I might just kind of jump in on your comment about limited resources, all of the big networks, which is, you know, who tends to get the largest share of the audience, the most eyes and ears and viewers and stuff, are on the coast, right? So then middle America sometimes gets lost. And that's where I think NPR is a strong player in the market, because they're already set up with member stations like ours to have voices and people in these areas and have regional reporters. And they really are kind of trying to push a new project to get more of that local voices and local reporting, and to get their reporters out of D.C. and out of the West Coast and into communities where they can tell the stories rather than just like flying in and flying right back out.
I'll jump in on that since you gave a plug to NPR. I'll give a plug to Gannett, you know, my company in the USA Today network, where there has been remarkable cooperation between the, I think we're up near 100 daily newspapers again. We have 8 or 9 within Ohio, and we coordinate with the Cincinnati Inquirer, we coordinate with several of the smaller papers in Ohio on a regular basis on stories that are of statewide interest. So we are very careful to work smart. As Patty said, there's a remarkable reduction in resources. And the other point I want to make is I think what the in this age of digital and video, and again, I'm speaking from someone who spent 30 plus years in print media, is the you find is there's more choices for people to consume and get their news and information, is that the basics never really go out of style. And some of the most well-received stories I've done in the last year have been regarding really tense issues within the Black community in Cincinnati. One was the expansion of Children's Hospital into the Avondale neighborhood, which is a historical, very important African-American community. And the current issue involving the FC Cincinnati proposed stadium in the West End. And I think when you go into those and you have some time and your editors give you a little time and space and you're painstaking about making it a fair fight, and when I say fair fight, it's finding sources on both sides of an issue that are articulate, well-spoken. For example, the whole issue with the West End, I did a lot of research and I tried to reveal a lot of the anger in the West End is historical. It goes back to the construction of I-75 and the displacement of so many African American families, the Kenyon Bar neighborhood, the piece of the West End that is now Queensgate, which is an industrial park, the deconstruction of the traditional public housing in the West End. So really, when FC Cincinnati is pitching its idea, it's not just working in current time, it's working against 60 years. And that's a long way to say that really when you go to that extra effort to adhere to the basics painstakingly, readers really do respond. And we did a couple – I worked as a part of a team with 3 or 4 other reporters in the children's expansion story. And people really respond that they – and one of the nicest things that you can hear as a reporter – is when someone will email you or call you and say, God, when I got to the end of that story, I didn't know what to think. I really kind of understood both sides. Unfortunately, that's hard to do, no matter how hard you try. But I think we realize that given, you know, you tweet, you're out covering something, you tweet, you post photos, you do Facebook Live. All of that is important and vital. And I guess the other piece, and I'll shut up after this, but the other piece in addition to diminished resources that really affects us are metrics. You know, you're having this collision of activism with metrics where it has to be kind of points of crisis that we cover and points of conflict, because that's what drives readership, especially when that can all be measured, you know, digitally. And that affects decisions that are made on news coverage. So you have to maintain as a reporter, you know, we have multiple people covering government and city hall and the establishment. And there's very few of us that spend the majority of our time kind of covering the anti-establishment, those marginalized communities. And I find myself increasingly, while I can't write everything I go do, I go to events knowing that unless something significant happens, I'm going just to show my face and maintain relationships. So when I need people, that I can count on them to, that I'm trusted, that I'm knowledgeable, that I've kept up on things. But it's a complex time and one that's very challenging.
Is it more complex, Mark, because of the ramped up news cycle as well, the 24/7
news cycle? That's a big part of it. And I think that's, again, plays into the demographics. You know, what we used to do in the 90s when there was only print and digital was in its infancy, you know, we didn't have those metrics. And as the metrics became king, you know, those really do drive the limited resources, where those limited resources are invested to, you know, knowledgeable, you know, good bets on what's going to drive a lot of traffic.
Right. And the facts are there. I mean, everybody says they want that hard hitting story about, you know, X, Y, or Z, and no one's talking about this. And I said, well, yeah, but we've seen the data. You're not reading it either. So, you know, I mean, I sound a little flip there, and I guess I am, but I have spent the last few years doing digital work.
Being the digital editor, yeah.
And looking at our analytics and knowing that we're doing all these great stories, and yet what people are reading is, you know, like Mr. Rogers got a new toy on his show or something. I mean, that's flip again, but the entertainment stories or the ones that are, that's what people are clicking. That's what people are sharing. So I get a little angry, I guess, when as a journalist, we get attacked for not covering the story. Well, you're not reading it either. All right, now I'll stop.
I think that brings us back to activism, the beginning topic here. So Mark Carnoot somewhat has to be an activist for the topics he thinks are important for Cincinnati audiences to know. And Tana, you have to be an activist or at least an advocate for the stories that you think are important, and you've got to fight every day in your newsroom for the time and the space to tell those stories. So, you know, without that individual dedication to certain story themes and topics, those do fall off the plate. You know, I know Mark, I know your personal history. You covered the Bengals. You made the choice to start covering social issues that you felt were important. Without that choice, I would venture to say the Cincinnati Enquirer would not be reporting those stories, or at least not reporting them very often. And I know you have a struggle on a day-to-day basis to convince your editors that you should report on and publish the findings that you painstakingly gather in the community. So, you know, does he have to be is that activism that he's picking certain stories? Well, in a sense, right? And I'll just be on record saying I think it's good activism in that sense because he is bringing important stories and continuing to fight to bring these important stories about immigration, DACA, and the Black community and Muslim community, et cetera, to Enquirer readers.
Is he being an activist or an advocate at that point?
Well, I don't know. I'll let him tackle that. I'm not assigning blame. I don't think it's a case of blame, but I do think he has to advocate or be an activist for those topics to get them in. They have great news value and they should be covered. But without his strong support of those topics, I doubt they would be. And because the Enquirer is the dominant media in town, if he wasn't covering them, then maybe Tana wouldn't read his story or WCPO wouldn't read his story and go, oh, that's something that we ought to cover as well. So,
but for the record, I actually have really good support, and there has been remarkable awareness corporate-wide and in our newsroom that these are really important topics, and I wouldn't be able to do what I do. I mean, I push, like I think any good reporter agitates, not just in the community but within his or her newsroom, but I have remarkable support.
Yeah, I think, I mean, as much as I don't like corporate media, Gannett has at least been a good citizen in allowing the local properties to do, I think, some very good work. I take us back to 2001 and the riots and the neighbor-to-neighbor project that the company invested in. I mean, they devoted a lot of resources to that in an effort to try to do something good for Cincinnati by taking the role as a good citizen. And I wish more media would do that.
We have a question from the audience over here. Sir, go right ahead.
Hi, my name is Mark. I have a kind of an observation leading to a not completely formulated question that I'd like any of you to pick up on. But I'm appalled by our current president's reckless vilification of just about everything. and on an hour-to-hour basis. This includes the judiciary, but in particular the media. So, and he's getting a lot of help from this Russian disinformation campaign. My question is, I fear that the long-term credibility of media is being really damaged with this, what's going to be like a years-long onslaught of this. And let's just say we get a hypothetical, we get an independent in the White House in 2020, unlikely, but just to completely break it from the two-party system, how can we kind of recover from this four-year barrage of this disinformation and this vilification of the media?
Well, the attack on media is not, it certainly hasn't been within the last year or so. You can go all the way back to the Nixon campaign in 68. I mean, they came up with an orchestrated campaign to take out the media by attacking their objectivity. And as a result of that, it has had a detrimental effect on media credibility that shows up in polls like Pew, Gallup. People don't trust the media. And all that Donald Trump did was take advantage of that. He twisted media bias into fake news.
Yeah, but I think he's taking it to heretofore stratospheric heights that we have, you know, just...
Well, I think that's where the social media platform plays a role in that, because it's just so much more amplified mm-hmm. today. You know, one thing gets said and 2 minutes later it's everywhere, and it gets shared, you know, as opposed to maybe word of mouth or where something might have been said and then put in a paper, or, you know, done behind the scenes like you were talking about. In fact, I got to hear Carl Bernstein speak this past fall, and he kind of said the same thing. We were all like, oh, what do you think about fake news? And he was all like, it's the same as it was mm-hmm. when I was covering Watergate. Mm-hmm.
So, the technology's different.
The technology's
that's
different.
That's the big thing.
The difference is we have a president who communicates via Twitter. And so he puts his anti-press rhetoric right out there, and it gets circulated very quickly and, as Tiana said, amplified. I do think it's more vicious than previous – well, certainly the previous administration was not viciously attacking the press on a daily basis. So your question is, how can we recover? I'll just repeat what Way Smarter editors say. You just have to keep doing good journalism.
Right.
You just have to put it out there, and that's how you recover, is by standing firm behind the First Amendment and good journalism.
And Margo, you've been patient up there all this time. Let's let you ask your question.
This is a question for the newspaper folks. If you were college students today, would you go into journalism? Why or why not? And what do you tell your students about the business?
I'm going to say something, and then I'm going to ask Patty to follow me up, because she knows the details of the journalism program here, obviously, inside and out. There is a need. We have some remarkable young journalists at the Inquirer and within Gannett that are only 2 and 3 years out of college, who are far better equipped to compete and do provocative, sophisticated work than I was when I graduated in 1984. So I think my advice would be, and I think this is where I'm going to hand the baton to Patty, but study journalism, but also study something else and have a plan, a really strong plan B.
Well, we have a something else at Miami, because we require our students to double major. But of course, I teach journalism. Do I want students to go into journalism? Yes, I want them to go into journalism. They don't always, but I think it's still a very viable field. I think it's an important field. I consider journalism a public service, so I'm a little bit altruistic in that regard. And even though we've had a contraction of the media field, there are many, many places that journalism students can apply their skills, and there are many smaller news organizations where they can gravitate and stay, or gravitate and use it as a stepping stone to other larger news organizations. So, yeah, I think journalism is still a really good choice.
Another question from the audience. Go right ahead.
Hi, I'm Chase. I'm a senior journalism major here at Miami, and I want to talk a little bit more about social media and the role of journalism in that. So Twitter, Facebook, and other social media websites, they incentivize sensationalism, where only the hottest takes and the biggest opinions sift their way up through the top. And so maybe going from opinion to action then to activism is the only way that writers can find their work, readable. Is that something that is happening, can happen?
I don't understand all the, the processes for Facebook and Twitter and what rises up. We're expected to be very active as reporters in social media. It's been that way probably for about, going on 7, 8, 9 years within the company. We're expanding into Reddit. We've had training on using Reddit. We've had training on using, they want us to be active and use LinkedIn to publicize our stories. For example, with Twitter and Facebook, make sure that you have a network of, for example, I had a story that's publishing in print tomorrow. It's been out on an ongoing issue with an actively gay Methodist minister in Cincinnati. And you make sure that that story gets to organizations and people who will retweet it, and all of it driving up metrics. I think, we could use a lot of synonyms for this issue. I mean, I think the one thing that I used this word earlier, and as I thought about this topic today, I think you find people, I think the stories that do well that are also responsibly told have a very strong sense of conflict and have, which has always been an important piece of storytelling, but have a very, kind of like a, people are like a deportation story, an immigration story, the moving closer to the edge of the cliff type of thing draws in readers. And we're very, and I think as much time as we can have in the storytelling, but clearly social media plays a huge role in what we do and the distribution and our metrics. And I think we just, again, have tried to be as smart as possible and get our work into the hands of sources, organizations that care about the topics we're writing about, and there's plenty of them out there.
No one visits the homepage on a website anymore. They find it on social media, they find it on Reddit. So, finding those avenues to get your work out there is very important.
Are you moonlighting in our corporate marketing department?
I spent a little time with the Inquirer, actually, yeah.
It looks like we have another question right behind you.
Hi, my name is Faith. What do you feel is the biggest responsibility for student journalists trying to take on these bigger topics and be taken seriously in the media?
Well, I mean, we kind of got asked that question earlier in a video that we were filming earlier this year for Democracy and Me, and we said, well, act professional and people will treat you professionally. And I think that goes a long way. As someone who used to look pretty young, when I would go in to interview someone, I would easily get passed over thinking, oh, that's the intern. But so you do your research, be informed, be prepared, have good questions, and then ask them.
I think, again, it's I think the best antidote to multiple questions that have come up about the attack on the media, about the challenges of the 24/7 news cycle, about diminished resources, about consumers with multiple choices for media. I think, again, the basics never go out of style. And the basics are accuracy, fairness. Those things make you as bulletproof as possible. And I think when you really adhere to those things to the best of your ability, that I think a large number of consumers, or at least a good number of consumers who want that, will spot that. And I think that's a thing as you're coming out of school, and in school, spell things correctly, do your research, be knowledgeable ahead of time. Don't be afraid to call a source back and say, hey, I'm not sure about this. Can you explain this to me again? I still do that. And I think a source responds really well to, I just want to make sure I get this right. There's a lot of information here. Help me, I call it the Columbo effect. And it predates you, but it's kind of not so much play dumb, but help me understand this because I'm not as smart as you are type of thing.
Hey, Mark and Patty, should students who are wanting to go into journalism, should they stay away from activism while they're in college so it doesn't follow them later when they're looking for a job?
I think that's a consideration. if a student would come to me and say, should I get involved in student government while I'm doing journalism, my answer is no. You do have to pick your allegiances, and also it robs you of time to do journalism. So you do, I don't think you should be both. I have a kind of a purist attitude toward that. That's what I practiced when I was a journalism student, and still even as a journalism educator, I don't get involved in issues. I study them, I talk about them, I read about them, I consume the journalism about them, but I still stay on the sidelines.
You know, and I think the warning has been sent out to any number of all fields, you know, job applicants going into all sorts of fields, is be careful what you post on social media, because people check out what you post on social media as well.
Yeah, Chris, did you want to expand on
that? I mean, it is. It's something that I tell every student that I speak with that they have to be mindful that employers, they do their research. They do deep background searches, and it's easy to pull stuff from Twitter and Reddit and Facebook and what have you. And, you know, what seemed like silly fun when you were a college freshman may end up hurting you when you're trying to get your first job.
Question over here. Go right ahead.
Hi, my name is Jean. I'd like to go back to one of the things that Chris mentioned at the very beginning, and that's the key issue for me about the public's ability to discern the difference between neutral journalists and activists in terms of the information that's shared. And I'd like the group to share what they would like to see happen to help rectify that.
I think that is a problem. I don't think that the general public makes discerns the difference between different journalistic identities, right? It's a messy world. And we have pundits, and we have, you know, if pundits are way over here and journalists are way over here, there's every variety in between. But to many viewers, watchers, readers, they're all just journalists. So the guy tweeting and kind of sounding like he's in the middle of a news story might be seen as a journalist to some readers of that Twitter feed. That's I don't know the solution to that.
The media.
Right, the media. It gets kind of just lumped together when people who are working the media certainly identify in a different way than the guy who tweets from his basement.
Right, and Facebook's kind of, I mean, they're saying they're trying to address that because everything looks the same on Facebook. If I share a link from WVXU, it looks the same as an Onion story, you know, so if somebody doesn't know what the Onion is, they get all mad because, you know, they've seen an Onion story and I can't believe somebody actually wrote this or whatever. Everything looks the same. So Facebook says they're trying to work on that. It's just, it's a hard thing, you know, because you've got one website that has to make a fix that fits all sizes. So I don't know how they're going to do it. I mean, the result for us is with their journalism program they're doing right now, is they want to value, and this goes back to analytics, they want to value quality interactions. So if we've got, I don't know, 1,000 people that like the WVXU page and, you know, 5 people like a story, then that story gets shown to 100 people and that's it because, you know, 5 people didn't all comment on it. Now, 5 people all comment on it and our story about whatever would get more visibility and would get shared and would get marked as a you know, a viable news source. So they're trying to figure it out, but it's in its infant stages, and who knows what they're going to do in 2 months.
I do think that media is very aware of this dilemma, and what I've seen is an increase in the amount of labeling of news. So this is a piece of opinion news. This is an analysis.
This is satire.
Whether that really sticks with the viewer, the listener, the reader, I'm not sure, but I think there's an awareness that we need more clarity.
Yeah. Patty, will distrust of the news media ever go away as long as people stick to their own particular places where they get their news, their own silos for news?
Yeah, I don't. This is a hard thing to turn around. It has been so long that political insiders of all stripes, they have advantages in making sure that they can move the media out of the way, and attacking the credibility has been the way they go about it. And as a result of that, you just have people who naturally go to the, if they don't like the story, it's because it's an obvious piece of media bias. And fixing that, particularly in this age where people are stuck in quote-unquote filter bubbles, it's a difficult prospect to try to fix, and I'm not quite sure how that gets done.
Yeah, and Patty, what are your thoughts on that?
It is a problem because there are so many choices for the consumer of news today, and people do gravitate toward the media that reflect their worldview establish menus of media that just continue to reflect their worldview, right? So I think one of the answers is to be a deliberate, we tell this to students, be a very deliberate news consumer. Make sure that you are, you have the same 24 hours every day. You get to decide how to use it. And when you're consuming news, consume wisely. Set up legitimate news sources. Set up a variety of news sources. Check your, check one story against another. I'm not sure if that advice falls on deaf ears, but that's what we do advise to students, as opposed to just consuming the news that we like or reflects our views.
Chase, you had another question?
She took my exact phrase, falling on deaf ears, yeah. So if people from both sides, you talked about people bashing you from both sides. I mean, it's fair reporting. People, say, no, you're this and you're that, but both coming at the same time. So what audience is then left if both sides hate you? Right, people re-watch and listen to what they already agree with. So, well, yes, the reporting is fair. Is it falling on deaf ears? Is there an audience for fair reporting?
Well, I'll just give an example. I also like to look on Reddit, the Cincinnati subreddit, and here's a group of people that love to bash the Inquirer like it's their day job. But when you look at what they share, it's just Inquirer story after Inquirer story after Inquirer story. And so you guys, they're doing the reporting that these people want to read. Clearly, and they're reading it, and they're they're discussing it. So
like hate reading,
huh?
Like they're hate reading, like hate watching a TV show.
Yeah, no, well, I guess maybe. Yeah. But so there's still the desire there. They just also want to.
Thanks
talk.
For reading, but
Mark,
I don't know, Mark.
As long as you click on it.
that's nice to hear. I'm new to Reddit. I'm just learning how to use it and work it. But I think I can say this from our newsroom. The effort that is made to do things the right way, to be fair, to be smart, to use our resources well, and I know I sound like a total company man for saying this, but it's all hands on deck to make this work, and that's what is required right now because there are so many outside forces just on us, and at least they're reading, at least they're watching, and if they want to rip us up and call us names, as long as they're clicking, as long as they're buying. That's been the history, and that's part of the deal when you get into this. It's much better to be, the worst thing is if they ignored us.
And at least you're creating a dialogue.
And there is, and there's plenty of it out there, and I think our job is to keep trying to provide the best substantiated, well-sourced, fair information, accurate information that lets people have at it. And that's historically been our job, and that I think will never go away.
Thank you to our panel today. We appreciate all of you being here.
Thank you very much.
And we'd like to thank everyone at Miami University for hosting us, with special thanks to Miami President Dr. Gregory Crawford, University News and Communications, Intercollegiate Athletics, Miami's football program, Coach Chuck Martin, and Coach Matt Yoches. Our producer today was Pete Reitmeier, with special help today from Ritter Hoy. Our assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Our engineers were Rick Andres and Josh Elstro. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now, coming up next on 91.7 WVXU and 88.5 WMUV.